schoolmans and boy princess holds. And a hundred more lads like me, I never was alone. And since I learned the princess stones would drive the Brits away, it wasn't very long before then I joined the IRA. Chucky Arna.
Hello comrades, and welcome back to Season 4, Episode 8 of Spectre. I'm absolutely delighted today to be joined by Cathal O'Galleen to talk about GAA and Palestine. Comrade, it's a pleasure to have you on today.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on. It's my pleasure to be here.
Magic. So just to start off, you know, a wee bit of an introduction from yourself, who you are, your affiliations and everything else in between.
Hi, so as I say, my name's Cathal. Based over here in Scotland, member of the CPB and the YCL, quite proudly. I suppose you can tell by my accent, not from here though. I come from the north of Ireland, still occupied Ireland. So I suppose, you know, growing up, you're kind of at the crux of two contradictions, you know, the class contradiction and the imperial contradiction, still kind of very raw, despite the kind of quiet it's gotten in the last, and compared to like 30 years ago. But yeah, so ended up over in Scotland, like most people from my neck of the woods. Ended up over here. A lot of these things became more apparent, became a lot more politically active. Ended up with obviously involved in sport over here, as I've been my whole life, Gaelic games, massive part of my culture. And I'm involved in the Palestine Solidarity Movement and working class politics. And I suppose these things all kind of conjugated together then with the project that helped bring Gaelic Games to Palestine.
Oh, good stuff, mate. Great to hear. And I guess for those who may have never heard of the GAA kind of like games and all that, or the GAA, depending if you're wearing O'Neill shorts or no, you know, can you give us a kind of insight into the game itself and then the kind of GAA in Palestine as well? Because it's, when you think about the games and the kind of history surrounding them, you know, there's some really beautiful intertwining with Palestine and the kind of shared history in that. So are you able to give us an insight for that?
Yeah, of course. GAA or the GAA, if you're speaking like the Paul Mescal lingo. So it's kind of what it is. It's Ireland's, you know, traditional sport. So there's two kind of main battles to it. You have Gaelic football, which is kind of like, to best describe it to someone in Britain, it's like if like rugby, basketball and soccer had a love child. And then you have hurling, which is a traditional game played with a stick, kind of not too dissimilar from Shinty. In fact, they play a compromised rules of each other, but very different origins. So yeah, it's an ancient sport. It's actually, that's that ancient, it's part of our kind of mythology. So the Cuchulainn cycle, and or the Cuchulainn legends and the Ulster cycle of, you know, which dates back to pre-Christian Ireland even. There's always a great story of Cuchulainn when he was a young fella. He was guarding his lord's castle and a massive dog approached the castle while there was a feast going on and everyone inside was drunk. So it was up to him to save the day. So he got his hurl and his slither, which is the name for the ball, and struck it down the dog's throat to save everyone. So that's how old it is. And it's kind of been played, you know, like informally, you know, since then. In fact, you know, you can see that the ancient slither has been dug out of bogs and stuff like this. But yeah, so it's kind of formalized in around the 1880s and the kind of Gaelic revival period of Ireland. So that was kind of in the kind of cultural context of Ireland post an Gortha Mór, post the penal laws and things like this, obviously still under the British Empire. So there's a massive push on to kind of ensure that Irish people could remain Irish and not just become West Brits. You know, so that involved our language, our music, our stories, and our traditions, and of course our games as part of that. So the GAA kind of became formalized around this time. So this kind of went from strength to strength over the years. So it did, and again, you know, people like Padraig Pearse would have been keen players, coaches, you know, leading up to the kind of revolutionary period in 1916. And again, GAA, well, because it was, to use the term now, it was cultural resistance. Because when your culture is being oppressed, to refuse to let it be oppressed is a massive form of resistance. So kind of, you know, there's a few kind of key elements or key dates, I should say, to it. So Gaelic Sunday in 1921, I believe. Oh no, 1918, sorry. When the British Army put a ban on any gatherings of Irish people over like five without permission. So the GAA organized matches of 3 p.m. all over the country, and 50,000 people turned out to defy this ban, you know, and stuff like this. So more tragically, in the first Bloody Sunday in 1921 in Croke Park, if any of you've seen the film, Michael Collins is depicted in that, not entirely truthfully, but you know, dramatized, but it gives you the idea, where there was a fundraising match for Republican prisoners. This was then attacked by the auxiliaries, who shot dead 14 people, innocent civilians, including children, including one Michael Hogan, the captain of Tipperary, to whom Hogan Stand, one of the main stands in Croke Park, is now named after. So again, this kind of continued more so as a form of resistance then in the north of Ireland, like the Occupied Six, where GAA members were routinely harassed, you know, facilities destroyed and things like this. I want to say over 300 members were killed over the course of the Troubles by paramilitaries, British Army, UVF, UDR, things like this. And like even, you know, down to things like, and this is still actually ongoing. So some certain councils in the north of Ireland, they could have dozens of soccer pitches ran by the council and one GAA pitch when there's a regular similarity in clubs. And in fact, you'll have more rugby pitches than soccer than GAA pitches, despite being a lot smaller rugby playing base, because a certain demographic tends to play one versus the other. Things like the Sean Brown murder inquiry. Sean Brown was the chairperson for his club in South Derry. Was bundled to the back of a car and shot dead with RUC collusion. MI5 refusing to release the files to this day. Or again, you know, it all comes in then to like the Irish language rights and stuff like this. So, yeah, it's, for us, it's always been a massive part of our cultural resistance. You know, like as I kind of said before, speaking in Belfast one time, like growing up as a young fella, you know, the two things that were most important to me as a child, on sport, Agus an Tíortha, so sport and freedom. And you're always wondering when you're going in like gates, because the gates are named after like our Fenian dead, our martyrs, you know, pitches and clubs and things like this. I'm not too far from a club named Kevin Lynch's, named Kevin Lynch the Hunger Striker. So all these similarities exist kind of symbolically with the Palestinian struggle, you know. I'll never try to compare the scale of barbarity between Ireland and Palestine. But the same systems, and you know, growing up, you always kind of recognize this. I think it's a main difference between Ireland and Britain in terms of Palestinian solidarity is back home it's the default, whereas here you're dealing with a lot different circumstance. So yeah, I suppose how this can then goes into Palestine, where is this kind of idea of cultural resistance over there? Obviously, you know, it's very different. You know, it's the dabka, it's the Arab styles of music, it's the dress. Food, place names, everything in between. And like again, lots of thematic similarities. So it kind of came about January 24, a couple of people got talking, so they did. And about these links between Ireland and Palestine, because not just symbolic, they've always been quite material as well. In terms of oppression, the Black and Tans were shipped directly from Ireland to Palestine. On the other side, you know, there's a lot of shared training camps in Lebanon, to put it lightly, and things like that. So it's kind of talking about, you know, what's another stage of this, you know, what can we do? An idea about these games came about because soccer and basketball and things like this are quite popular in Palestine, but not many stick games. So it's, people seen this and it's, you know, it's like, I'm quite proud because hurling's so unique. It's the fastest game on grass, and people saw us like, oh my God, this is unbelievable. So eventually it's kind of rumbled on until about July, when woman Claire Liddy went over with a different organization doing humanitarian work and bought a few bits of equipment with her and just took it and had it, did a wee bit with the kids to see if they'd enjoy it. And they loved it, took it to like a duck to water. I suppose that's where I seen this then. I was like, again, oh, I have to get involved. I have to get involved. And then up with me in Ramallah in early 2025.
Oh, good stuff, mate. That's great to hear. And When we talk about the kind of shared history of it and everything, the parallels that you see today, obviously we'll come on to talk about, your actual time there as well. But even just looking, historically in Ireland, in the occupied six counties, then now, you still have the murals dedicated to, solidarity with POWs, and and it was the case of many young Irishmen being interned without charge, conviction, and it's the exact same thing happening with the apartheid regime, with young children being abducted off the streets, and it's one of those things. It's heartbreaking, I guess, to see history repeat itself in that way. And when it comes to looking at, the occupied North, the now, it's almost some folk will refuse to kind of try draw that history and to draw the shared struggle. But although, Britain adapted its colonial project, or certainly reshaped it into, today's a neo-colonial or imperialist station in the North, it's that nature of, between the progression of capitalism, or the ever-changing form of it, that's still relevant in Palestine now. And I think there's many folk, when we talk about the national question and stuff like that in Britain, with the various nations, who do themselves a disservice of, not drawing on what's happening to, we're Irish brothers and sisters just across the pond, and that's without even talking about the Free State, or the politics behind that as well, which is its own subject in
Yeah,
itself.
I think
But
it's quite interesting when you draw this kind of parallel in terms of the capitalist contradiction between the north of Ireland and Palestine. And again, I'm never going to say they're the same, but there's a great book I'd recommend everyone listen to read by Oran de Valera. It's called Neglect in the North of Ireland, and he makes the point that the north of Ireland is essentially Britain's call center because it's cheap English speaking labor. So between this twin access to the UK and the EU market, we're kind of into both kind of, you could strangle by both ropes of imperialism there. This is a massively profitable boon for Britain and obviously the EU as well, it's the same, or it's not the same, it's similar in Palestine because, the Zionist economy's in tatters at the minute. And big reasons in tatters is they have no access to Palestinian labor from Gaza or from the West Bank because that labor exists and has since maybe a couple of years after 1967 as a super exploited underclass of workers, so again, and like, look, for a lot of it, it's the same companies and things like this, like there is. Everywhere you look, you can find a parallel. Obviously, it's the same if you look at any struggle worldwide, but I suppose just I can only speak for the two that I have the most experience of.
yeah, no, buy on. And I think it's kind of, it shows that the fact that the progression or the advancement and, Israel's offensive in Gaza, being backed by the likes of Trump talking about flattening the city down and, rebuilding on their terms, and it's, putting in business and all that to, these workplaces. And like you touched on, in terms of the actual Palestinian labor, I think one of the things I read a while ago was, I think it was a Friends of the Earth delegation to Palestine, and they were going through various parts of the West Bank and whatnot, and they saw the conditions in which, workers are treated, and it's purposely targeting Palestinian Arab workers because they know they can get away with doing anything to them, not just missing out on health and safety inspections or stuff that, we'd go ballistic for here, but, beatings, regular, unheard of exploitation, certainly in our realm, but the humanitarian violations that occur on these people, the Palestinians, even within Israel's own apartheid, Dendi, who's deemed to be Arabic. It's that strange irony of, Israel of all places repeating the Nazi blood laws and genes. So no, I thought you're absolutely right to talk about the system in which the, Arabic people, Palestinians, are exploited, and that kind of plays, as you've seen it, in your time there into the actual system of apartheid, which isn't anything kind of new to the world. You know, you talk about bringing it back to Ireland, even the occupied six just now, it was, an uncommon wave of Ulster Scots, English, Welsh being planted in from the north, and making their way down, and the Irish became the second class citizen as well, and that's the case here, for the Palestinian people. So just to, I guess, reflect in your time in Palestine, you've seen the apartheid system firsthand, just the real barbarity of Israel's cannibalistic, system in terms of how it operates. But more importantly than that, you've actually witnessed the kind of, resilience of the Palestinian people in the face of that repression, because it's for the years in which Israel's existed, it's taken on many different forms, from drawing inspiration from all different groups as well. So just to see if you can tell us about your time in Palestine, with the GAA games and that as well, but it's, also just touching on the actual system and how you can see it play and affect in day-to-day life for the people.
Yeah, I suppose is a phrase I love to use when talking about my time there. And you've seen the best and the worst of humanity, you know? And I suppose I'll touch, just because you mentioned the first and the worst side. So it's the things like the Calandia checkpoint, you know? I can only describe it as kind of like an infrastructure of terror. I'm trying to think of something to compare it to in Britain, even as like a. It's nearly like if Cumbernauld Town Centre was there to make you feel like you're not human. There's the high walls, the cameras everywhere, the massive flags that serve purely as an intimidation tactic and to let you know who's in charge. The concrete, even things like near the settlements, like a kind of dot around it on the road out from Al Quds. The walls changed slightly because the settlers, in occupied East Jerusalem want to have a bit of their view retained. But once in the Palestinian area near like a camp, now, as high as we can get them, as close to the wall as we can get them. So it's like, that's the introduction. So it is. I think it was really, really noticeable the first time I was there. To leave Al Quds wasn't that difficult, but to come back in, the traffic in the other direction was piled high, because if Arabs leave, East Jerusalem, the Zionists don't care. Go on, get out. They want to make it as difficult as possible to have Palestinian life in that city, never mind, in any other locality. So there's that, and never mind, that's not even getting into the talk of what license plate you have on your car decides where you can drive, whether it's yellow for an Israeli reg or white or green for a Palestinian one, to the point where having the wrong license plate and approaching this place could get you in serious trouble. And I don't mean like, a fine, I mean beaten, arrested, kidnapped, shot. These things happen. So there's that. They're seeing the settlements, which, if any's ever read Murad Barghouti, I Saw Ramallah, he makes a great point about his first time coming back in the 90s, and you see these lights that dot the hilltops, and it is like that, You can see them, and you see the big signal towers, which I recognize from army bases back home. Like they're a piece of military infrastructure, and they're blinking red light and stuff like this. So one of the settlements that go, you're looking up at it, and it's on top of a hill. And it's less like, because, architecturally, urban planning wise, these are all suburbs, so they are. But it doesn't feel like a suburb or look like a suburb. It's like a barracks with housing, There's a line of trees, so there is at a strategic height, to make sure that you can't really get up there too handy. The grass is bright green because they have all the water. Everything's concentric and well planned and well thought out, there's compounds at entrances, and you know, I think I'll come back to a story about that, or places like Bet El, you know, like one of the most violent settlements in the West Bank, the major IDF base in the West Bank. And there's things like streets, you can't go down at night. I remember going past one of them and you're speeding, and I think going quicker in the car was my heart, because that's what it is. Like, there's tires every, 20 meters there. And like, these are massive, big concrete things, you know, that obviously at a massive cost, they're there and stuff like this. There's, you know, the regular road points and checkpoints that the UN have all documented, and seeing, you know, people. I distinctly remember seeing a soldier, and on his patch, it was like one of these like half and half flags patches on his arm, and the top half was the Israeli flag, and the bottom half was, you know, the Punisher logo from, is it Marvel? Which obviously a lot of right-wing Americans use to symbolize something. So like, that's straight away giving the game away. This guy's coming over from Brooklyn or Florida or LA or God knows where. So there's that, or seeing a random checkpoint at coming into Bethlehem and stop for 3 hours and watch the blue lit ambulance pull up behind us and just have to wait, because life just doesn't matter, you know. Or two Palestinian men arrested by the side of the road for nothing, more than likely. Stuff like this, you know. I never even mind like having to plan your travel around making sure there's daylight, because at night the gates close and you get caught, you're caught, and God knows what could happen to you, you know. And like, because it is an apartheid state, you are constantly aware, because you're European, you're a little bit safer, but you're not quite safe. And you're always in your mind thinking, this is me for a while. This is other people's everyday lives, you know. Like, it's always described to my friend as it's the big prison. And that's the only word for it, is the big prison. Like, to try go from, like, for example, just to really hammer it home, to go from Al Khalil or Hebron to Amman, if you drive it straight, it would take 2 hours maybe. With all the checkpoints and the borders and whatnot, it takes about 14 if you're lucky. And that's what you're dealing with. It's the same going from, you know, Ramallah, if you want to go to Tulkarem or Bethlehem, as it's described, or Al Khalil or wherever. This fragmentation of Palestinian communities just being enforced through violence or threats of violence. But that's that side of it. And then there's a complete other side of the coin, and that's the Palestinian communities. So I was in Mukayam Al-Amri, so Al-Amri refugee camp. It's been there since 1948 from the Nakba. Most of the residents, they come from places, you know, kind of like the coastal plain, like around Yaffa, Al Ramla, Lida, you know, few from like Al Quds and like places like this, you know. So it's about 8,000 people there on but less than 1,000 dunams, so less than a square kilometer. Like, and you can still, like, for any doesn't know, the camps are kind of defined by these zakat, they're called. So the cats are like, they're like the alleyways, because the way the camp started, they started as tents, because they're always a very temporary place. They still are a temporary place, because the Palestinian refugees have a right to return and surrounded in international law. So these things started as tents, and then tents became kind of, you know, like some mud huts, some kind of like little like informal buildings, as we would call them, and then eventually concrete structures, you know, built by UNRWA. And but you still see the line, the very narrow lines of circulation space. But in these little alleys and in these streets and whatever, what you find is something unbelievable. People talk about Irish hospitality. Irish hospitality is nothing on Arab hospitality. The many times I was walking down and just looking around me, and you know, it's not, oh, hi, what's the crack? How are you? Do you want a pint? It's, salaam alaikum, kif haluk. And then you're inside someone's house having a coffee, you know, and you might not speak a word of the same language between each other, but it's this kind of sense of appreciation, you know, or stuff like this, or like little simple things, like just speaking on coffee. There's a little place we went for breakfast the whole time, and as in myself, and the guy had about, five words of English, and I had four words of Arabic, and two of those were Salaam Alaikum. But we still managed to sit and talk, and there was ceasefire news being broken, and talk, and like enjoy this together, and then end up watching the Super Cup highlights, between Barca and Real. These real beautiful human moments. Not to mention the food, and I've never been fed better. Everywhere you go, you're getting offered more and more and more and more and more. So this kind of real sense of community, it's very strong. It's very much, it's the same you find over here. The people with the least give the most, because everyone remembers what it's like to be tough. Everyone knows what it's like to have been on tough times, and they welcome you in, So stuff like that, or seeing the services provided in the camp, in terms of every, like, I saw the best gym I've ever seen. The guys have put this in there, two floors, swimming pool, this whole shebang, because they work hard and they take pride in it, and the sport's one of their things. And the guy who runs it was a Palestinian champion weightlifter, like, and this is his life's joy. So stuff like that, or they have a great physio set up with like a cryo pool, or those cold pools, stuff like that, or like the committee for the orphans, because there's a lot of orphans, but how the community pulls together to look after these people, or giving, or like adults with like developmental disabilities, and making sure they're cared for and look after, and somewhere to spend the day. Same building was used to have a hostel function, but now it's being used for refugees from Gaza who work inside the 48 territories but were expelled following October 7th. So these people who more likely may be refugees twice in their lifetime now. So it's everything like this, and seeing the work that people put into the communities through all the organizations, through the scouts, through sport clubs, after school clubs, the schools in general, everyone you meet, like all the children, the young adults, whatever, everyone's either an academic or a painter or a musician or a sports person. It's a real pride in being the best you can at something, and yes, well, okay, I've been talking about 5 minutes straight, so I can wax lyrical more, but I won't waffle too much.
No, that's good, mate. I mean, it's reassuring for me as a man who can just about speak English that I can make my way through Palestine with just a wee cup of coffee and Mahon and the football
Hi.
highlights. But no, I mean, that's a great kind of roundup, mate. I mean, one of the first episodes I done for the podcast was with the guys from the Glasgow Palestine Human Rights Campaign who've got their stall on Buchanan Street every Saturday, and Margaret telling me her experience of going over, and she had an absolutely brutal time. She was identified, coming off wherever she was, as being a Palestinian solidarity activist, and she was detained, and was just held under horrendous conditions. But during her time there, she saw just the like you said, the brutality of kind of like everyday life for them. And it was a case of children trying to make their way to school and with bricks being thrown at them. Where have we seen that before? We're going back to the Occupied Six again. But there's it's the kind of stories they've heard for people who've went years ago are just the same now. October 7th was never, an accelerating factor in Israel's colonial project or, the input of its apartheid regime. It's always been there, and it's always been just as brutal as we know it today.
Yeah, because even like you make that point about this since starting October 7th, which of course didn't, October 7th, was it was an expression of an occupied people, because like if you read the statement from all the factions, it's saying, well, we looked at what's happened on the West Bank, we looked at the Abraham Accords, we felt we had to act, and this does go back, as you say, this kind of, because it is a central colonial project, and central colonial projects always seek to exclude, whether that's in like French Algeria, or whether that's in South Africa or wherever else. And I think, it's an important thing to, like, always sticks in my mind is the Histadrut, it kind of speaks a little bit. I think it's something we need to be aware of, especially here in Britain, is that trade unions aren't inherently progressive. So the history of it was the kind of Zionist trade union movement in Palestine. Again, a lot of the early Zionists were influenced by, ideas of the Second International and stuff like this. But it was Zionist only. Arabs weren't allowed into it, and even like a talk about where some of the residents from Al-Amari came from. One of them is a place called Wadi Hunain. Wadi Hunain was beside a settlement, Nesazania, from like the second Aliyah or whatever they call it. Nesazania was despised by the mainstream Zionist movement because they employed Arab labor. It was seen as the only kind of genuinely mixed locality outside of like Haifa or Jaffa or Jerusalem. And so this drew loads of scorn from the mainstream Zionist movement. But despite this, it was still ethnically cleansed in 1948. So yeah, this has always been there. This is the nature of Zionism. There's no such thing as a liberal Zionism or a socialist Zionism or a far-right Zionism. Zionism is Zionism. It is an apartheid mentality, as a supremacist mentality, as a colonial mentality. We talked again about 1948, all the different currents, whether it was the Haganah or the Stern Gang or whatever else. They all argue among themselves, but they all want the same thing, and that's constant expansion, and we see that now. So we do, especially going into Syria and parts of Lebanon and stuff like this. But yeah, that's getting very historical on it.
No, I mean that's a good roundup, mate. I mean, aye, it's all hard to put into words, I guess, sometimes, and certainly from your experience, you're probably better at it than me actually being there. But there's no covering for Zionism in terms of its ideology, no way to twist things from the fact. But that being said, the Israeli propaganda machine is very well funded, and you don't even have to look too far into who's saying what or where money goes. You only need to look at the kind of main structure of the argument used for the ongoing genocide in Gaza, and it's been pinpointing and only putting Hamas in the spotlight, making it out as in Hamas is the only force of the Palestinian people, and Hamas is Palestine. But we know that there's a number of organizations and groups, parties, DFLP, PFLP, and all these other groups that since well before the 7th of October have been fighting against Zionism. But Israel's main focal point has been putting Hamas in the center stage, and only that, not mentioning any of the other groups, as well as a clear kind of indicator, playing up Islamophobia and all that, this message to the West that this is what's coming, this is the only force there that's making its way westward. It's why you get like crooks like Tommy Robinson, whose main job is it here in Britain to stoke is that racism, to put the fear of Islam into people's hearts, and in turn, if we can get people scared of that, Israel can go further and justify itself in various actions and bombing campaigns and et cetera, et cetera. But with you having seen the worst of it, I'm glad that during your time there that you've also seen the best, and especially within like the young people and the kids and actually doing the sport over there. So how was the kind of the GAA games received by the youth over there? I know you said at the start, they loved it, they just took right to it, but in terms of overcoming language barriers and et cetera and all the other things, terminology for the games, it's something that's just totally new to them. How did that go, actually implementing training games, et cetera?
I think what so I'll get into the specifics of it, but I think the first thing that made it so successful with the children was they're all good as gold. They're all great wee guys, so they are they all have their own personalities and they're masters, don't get me wrong now, but they're really, really good kids, so they are have great time for each other and respect for themselves and dignity in themselves, and all this. And I think this kind of like respect for outsiders too. So like obviously like Palestine's obviously a mixed locality, but it is majority Muslim. So like I have a few kind of like bodily modifications, put it that way, that kind of identify me out as a Westerner. So you get some of the kids come up to you and they kind of point at this and they go, that's haram, that's haram. And you go back to them, and I'm a Messiah. They go, I'm a Christian. They just go, oh, okay. And just walk off again, you know, like it's just like, all right, okay, then that's fine. There's no qualms or ifs, buts or whatever about it. Like, so that's, you know, anyone wants to talk about some kind of, you know, Salafi Palestine, they're chatting out the rank, forgive my French. Like, it's a mixed locality, has always been a mixed locality. And any resistance movement, the vast majority of resistance movement, I'll correct myself, of any strain, their sole and only focus is Palestine and the freedom for Palestine. None of this stuff that gets whipped up by the media, by, you know, Stephen Yaxley Leonard, or whatever he calls himself these days, or whatever else. But anyways, I digress. So yeah, so initially, I was kind of going out with the idea of maybe like, you know, 15 or so kids, which is fine, you know. That's, you know, 15 makes a team, so it's like perfect. That's grand. There were two of us, and then a couple of the Palestinian guys as well, because like the whole point of this wasn't just to go and do something for a while and then bugger off again and be like, oh, we did great, you know. Not at all, because this is all about solidarity, not charity. You know, it's no gift. It's working with people, and building bridges and building things. Like, there's a massive difference in that for me. Like, no one's trying to say, claim they're giving a gift to the Palestinian people, because they don't need a gift. They're not a charity case. They're not coming begging us. Like, not at all. So yeah, getting the coaches involved was a big part of it. But anyways, so again, camp of 8,000 people. But there's only one pitch to serve that camp. Some surrounding neighborhoods in Albert and stuff like this, because again, because everything's affected by the occupation. So we're going training in the school run by UNRWA. So then I was introduced to the principal, and you know, introduced to some lovely guy, or whatever. And he goes, "Oh, you're taking the training later." I was like, "Yeah, I am." And he hands me this list of all these other boys that are interested. There's 30 of them, and I was like, "Oh my God, what are we going to do here?" But that was fine anyway. We got them all in. And it spoke with the language barrier, you know. It was quite funny because it really made you think about, I always got the advice for it, was like, when you're teaching kids, make it as simple as possible. Well, it has to be simple because it can't get complex ideas across. So the real simple stuff about, you know, show and tell, nice little activities to keep them interested, and stuff they can see you doing and immediately do themselves. So it's just to starting from the very, very basics, you know, scratch. Same with our Irish kids that are starting out. You know, how do you hold the stick correctly? Making sure the stick's the right size for you. You know, making sure you're using your wrists and not your shoulders, and all these kind of points and stuff like this. And it was just, you know, and slowly introducing them to it, so doing that. And obviously, it's kids. You want to make sure they have fun. So, you know, sure, they're doing this, and then getting them the sticks across each other. It's like, A, get them used to the bit of the clash of the ash and the noise. And B, you know, it's a bit of fun. You're mating, you're whatever, like, you're on your fighting. And then kind of introducing the ball to them and how to strike it and stuff like this. So each kind of day, you know, every couple of days of training or whatever, like I kind of introduce a new skill and a new skill and a new skill, just like a kind of five kind of fundamental basics of hurling, you know, kind of striking, lifting, catching, blocking on your first touch. So it's kind of working about this, and seeing how diligently they worked was amazing. You know, so two things stood out to me. So come the end, the skill that they had increased in that short space of time was unbelievable. Like, these are kids, like, you had a little bit of an introduction in July, but not major. But where, you know, like, they looked like, oh yeah, these kids play hurling, you know, it's that kind of a way. Like, you've got to be match going for them and all. And you're sitting, I was sitting there, I was doing goals for it, like, and I was like, oh my God, this is something else. And then the other one was seeing the older kids looking after the younger kids and like teaching them and making sure they understood it, you know, and stuff like this. So it was obviously that part of it. And then there was, you know, taking the coaches, the people who are going to be involved, and making sure they understood it. And I was lucky enough, Amr is an unbelievable guy. He was, you know, he's good English, thank God. So, you know, teaching him, like, kind of speaking the technical points and stuff like this, and what you need to watch out for, what kids tend to do and how to correct it and stuff like this, you know. And as I say, this kind of idea of like dedication to the community, and like love for it. It's always they're so eager and so mad to know more. Like, so I was working through that, and as I think it's one of the biggest honors I ever had in my life. So the club was kind of named after a young man, Mota Sarsour was involved with the club originally in July. And he was murdered just over a year ago, August 13th. He was 17 years old and was shot dead by the occupation. And his family gave permission to give this and his name to the club. So we went and met the family. And the father, and I'd say we were giving condolences first of all, and then giving thanks. And the father said, he goes, I'm glad now my son's name will live forever as a link between my nation and yours. You know, because obviously it's like the psychosocial aspect of it, of, you know, distraction for kids' mental health, a chance to speak to kids for a little bit. Even simple things of kids that aren't good at soccer might be good at this, which is some of them are. I was the same myself when I was a child. But then there also is the bigger picture of this for them. Is another way they can stand up and look at the occupation and say, we do not care what you say. If we want to make a link with this country, we're going to do it. If we want to do this, you cannot stop us. You know, and like that's what it's all about. So yeah, so as I say, yeah, just seeing like even like it's little funny things like I say about like you know with the language barriers, like so like I do my left and my right, you know, Bishmal, you mean, Bishmal, you mean. And the kids are starting to catch on, this is all you do. So take the piss out of you, start reading it back to you and stuff like this, you know. Like, wherever you go, masters are masters. Like, but it's, you know, oh, great to see. Great to see.
Oh, that's good, mate. And I mean, we've touched on the kind of difficulties in terms of day-to-day life and all that. Seeing firsthand, you know, yourself, the actual system of apartheid. You know, what kind of difficulties did you know, run into in terms of, you know, getting things functioning over there, especially with the facilities, the pitch or whatnot? Because obviously, you know, as a Celtic fan, I've seen the international solidarity between the likes of the Green Brigade in Palestine as well. We're helping with the pitches in the area, and you know they're terrorized essentially by the IOF, and makes the effort of continued, you know, aid to various groups, you know, ever more occurring. Becomes harder here, especially when it's, you know, it's working class people leading the charge, and we're already in the midst of, you know, where so-called cost of living crisis, austerity now again, but you know under the operation of Labour. But in terms of you know, you guys there, you know, teaching them the games, getting out of running, sporting equipment, etc. You know, what were the kind of difficulties you faced against the you know Israeli occupation forces and just maintaining, like you said, not just doing it and leaving, but giving the gift of the GEA to them.
I sorry, I maybe misspoke earlier, but I'll say very clear, that's not a gift. We're not giving anything. We're working, you know. I can't be clear enough about that. But yeah, so I suppose in terms of logistics, the first of all I say is equipment. Is getting equipment there is quite difficult. Because the Zionists don't like to see anything going to Palestine. Where that's, you know, Gaza when it was under the siege, not the ongoing genocide, or we see it now as well. With the thousands of trucks piled up at Rafah. But yeah, so getting equipment there is very difficult. Things get rejected all the time at borders or held up or God knows what, you know, and things like this. But like, so obviously the sticks are quite important because they're made from ash, quite unique, stuff like this. But for every, you know, encounter, there's some way to overcome it. So now, for the first time, to my knowledge, outside of Ireland, there's someone making hurdles in Palestine. You know, so simple things like this. You know, in terms of pitches in Ramallah, we were quite lucky because although it was difficult to access a pitch time wise, there was a pitch there. You know, we could use if we played our cards right. Whereas in Tulkarem, where the ongoing raids, a piece of land that was going to be signed over by the municipality was bulldozed. You know. But despite all this, they're out back once again. I got things settled a little bit and a little bit of, you know, life back together. they're out training the gate and a lot of ground they're able to find on the pitch and stuff like this, you know. So like there's definitely these kind of problems to overcome, and in terms of, you know, because again the whole thing about like, you know, you're trying to build solidarity and something self-sustaining, so like people being able to travel between each other, you know, it's quite difficult, quite dangerous. At times it's hard to guarantee and to make firm plans and stuff like this. So yeah, there's definitely a lot of challenges, but you know, where there's a will, there's a way. These challenges can be kind of always overcome. I suppose you kind of touch on, you know, what we're facing here and what they're facing there and trying to support it. Because obviously, yeah, like the charges led by working class people, and you know, don't get me wrong, there is kind of progressive elements of, you know, the petty bourgeois or whatever, like that do kind of lend their support, and fair play to them, that's appreciated, you know, but like it's never going to be the bulk mass. So we do have our own struggles and whatever else, but you know, like there's, I guess, saying back home, Nil Sirsa go Sirsa in Palestine, there's no freedom without Palestine's freedom. And they quote that man, Kamar Fahmy, if you strike imperialism anywhere, you strike it everywhere. So always believe that, like, whatever little bit you can do, and not, it doesn't have to be money, because not everyone has money, but everyone has shoe leather. You know, it plays a massive difference. So it is, you talk about the great initiatives of, you know, the Green Brigade with Laji, unbelievable work. Seeing Ada Camp and seeing how it's decorated and the system they have there and what they're able to do for the community, it's unbelievable. It's mesmerizing, and despite it all, because like, Al Amri, despite, you know, everything else, is a quiet camp, quote unquote. Whereas the camp, the army base literally borders it, you know, so it's different circumstances. But again, they overcome it, they work, they don't stop, and they're producing something beautiful there. So yeah, like I think like your fight, like when you're fighting this and you're realizing your rights, you know, and you're agency as a working class person and as a and a working class movement, this can only benefit you at home as well as benefiting those you stand in solidarity with, you know. So get involved in your boycotts, get involved in your trade unions, and push your trade unions to take a correct position on this, you know, or whatever other community groups there may be. Because, you know, the things, your tools you learn in doing this and helping this out can very much be applied then when you're organizing, you know, for this, hopefully another winter fuel payments are cut and their bills rising, you know, where it's about that, where it's about your rents, whether it's about job losses or rate hikes or whatever it may be, you know, it's all a very long struggle. So every single bit you pick up along the way is massively useful, both here and internationally.
Yeah, no, well said. And especially in there kind of ties in the fact that, you know, it's a class issue at the core of it. Think of the billions of pounds it's spent by Britain to maintain the Zionist regime, and not only that, the to subsidize the projects and developments of BA systems and the technologies that they test on Palestinians there. You know, get cease all that, you know, hold Israel to account and stop funding it, even just for starters, and you'd see an improvement in people's living standards here in Scotland. But no, I thought it was well said, mate. And I guess you've talked about the challenges, you know, fighting against the Israeli regime. Sometimes there's the challenges much closer to home, and yeah,
Oh God, don't start. This is a
yeah.
funny one.
But yeah, I mean the initiative you guys were working to achieve in terms of doing what is utterly amazing. I was really impressed when, you know, I first heard about it and what the plans were in terms of bringing the kids to Ireland, the home of the GAA, to, you know, see it in all its glory, essentially. But there's difficulties even with that. If you want to kind of give us the story in terms of, you know, the challenges faced and ultimately what had to happen instead.
Yeah, so I thought the plan was for a 2 week tour of Ireland at the end of July, starting Friday the 18th, so just before the All-Ireland final on the Sunday. which is the single biggest day in the Irish calendar, full stop. So the original itinerary was to land in Dublin, go south, go west, go north, go into Derry, go into Belfast, and finish up in Dublin again. So first of all, this had to be axed because it was completely unfeasible to get visas for the Occupied Six. So someone in London decided who can or who cannot come to our island. It would have cost, I think, in the region of £10,000. Passports had to be sent, had to be hand delivered to Tel Aviv, which logistically I don't know how that was meant to happen. Stuff like this. So that had to be changed, and if I'm Belfast and Derry, if any ever haven't got the chance, go and see what the solid Ireland street looks like. The reception they got it would have been unbelievable. But anyways, and that's no disrespect to the rest of Ireland. But yeah. So anyway, plans changed. So it was gonna be Dublin for a couple of nights. Night in Tipperary, so Tipperary is like the furthest, is like the home of the GAA, is where it was founded. Cork, Clare, on the west coast, Galway, up to Donegal as well, the most gorgeous part of Ireland. And then back to Dublin again. So some of the things that were penciled in was, receptions, getting led into certain places by the RTÉ band, which, plays the national anthem before Ireland finals. Getting stadium tours and of Semple Stadium, and had to send on each of the kids' picture and name because they're going to play it up in the bit, show it up on the big screen for them. And then just the real simple things, like there's plenty of beach trips planned. Because these kids live 20 kilometers, or not 20 kilometers, about 30 kilometers away from the ocean, they can see it from a hill near their house, but they're not allowed to go because of who they are. So they will get the chance for them to go to the sea. So things like this, and just lots of activities, and getting the chance to be kids and playing games, and again, it's getting coaching for the adults and stuff too, and getting meeting people to grow the game. So this process started in early March, if I'm getting my dates right, but then around that kind of time frame. Make contact with the embassy that's in that city just north of Occupied Jaffa. So talking to them and kind of visas of things and whatever. So we started to go through it and getting the forms filled out and passports and birth certs and parental signatures and whatnot. And we had to book the flights in advance. So it was about $40,000 spent. So stuff like this. And then it kind of went radio silent and we heard nothing. And then we kind of chased them up. We got said, oh, we need additional documents. So we got all the additional documents together. I put them in and then went quiet again and we chased them. And we got an email that not a word of a lie said, we misplaced them. Dot, dot, dot. Oops. Can you send them again? That's what you're dealing with. So anyways, again, nothing, nothing, nothing. I was getting really, really close now. So it was about 2 weeks before. So we kind of went in the media offensive and we said, just give us an answer. And then soon after that, we got our answer. An answer what we suspected it would be. It was a denial. Denial was on grounds which were spurious from the point of like saying documents not submitted, which were asked for documents that can't exist or silly things like that. I think the most egregious, which I said this on national radio, which got me a funny look off of South Dublin presenter, was either incompetence of the highest degree or the worst form of malice that they said there's no adequate guarantee that these people will return to their country of origin. For people who have been for 77 years resisting by simply staying on their land, facing a government who wants to cleanse them and only exist to cleanse them, to say they're not going to return is a statement that doesn't even bear speaking about. So like I think this speaks to the nature of the Free State government. Like again, I swear I'm not a quote machine, but that Conley one about if you raise the green flag over Ireland tomorrow, it doesn't matter unless you kick out the capitalists because then Britain will still rule you through them. And this is what's proven true. Jennifer McNeill, she was speaking today at the Michael Collins Memorial in Bell na Blah. And making a big claim about we need to get rid of our triple lock of neutrality. The only people that benefits is the EU and NATO and having more cannon fodder for us to join their imperialist wars that they're trying to ramp up. She last year met with, as been reported by the Dutch, met with an Israeli spy in the Taoiseach's office. So that is kind of what you're dealing with. Or whether it's on other levels, you know, we talk about the triple lock of imperialism in Ireland, where it's the occupation of the North, the EU, and the American military's use of Shannon Airport, you know, which the government not only allows but subsidizes because we don't charge them the fees to land as you do regular flights. Stuff like this. So, yeah, you're dealing with a government that is the inheritors of the pro-treaty side, you know, like that Civil War fracture has never really healed. You still have that contradiction of an occupation in the north. So, despite things like the Occupied Territories Bill, which is great, it's really, really good where it's going to be if it's implemented right. But it was like a concession to the overwhelming masses of the demands of the Irish people. It's been in the works since 2018. And even now, they're trying to water it down and not include services. And Irish people on the street, flat out, all the time, in villages, towns, everywhere, you know, demanding more. So that's what you were dealing with. And look, we said we went in the media offensive. We said, look, this is unbelievable. We have our documentation. The GAA backed us up in terms of they remember child safeguarding and whatever else. Said, yep, they're totally happy. You know, so stuff like this. And we said to the government, come speak to us. And we're led on to believe meetings and meetings and meetings and never transpired. I end up we had to say, no, look, we have to pull the pin. So that's when Plan C went into action. So Plan C was, so if you have to, if you want to leave the West Bank, you have to go to Jordan, because you're not allowed into 48 Palestine. Others are not allowed to build an airport of their own. So we said, right, the kids deserve something. This is breaking their hearts. And one of the girls involved, I remember speaking and I brought her to tears about all this. She was translating and she was saying that Palestinian kids don't dream because how can they? They're just trying to get by. So to give them something to dream about and then to take it away from them will be like crushing them, you know? So we had to do something. So we kind of all clubbed together, clubbed our heads together between Ireland and Palestine. And we said, right, we'll go to Jordan. So in about 48 hours, we planned a trip to Jordan. Got out there. And to see all those children and all the adults and everyone else again was something unbelievable. To be reunited. We're lucky enough to be joined by three hurlers from Dublin. Two inter-county players and one game development officer who, you know, if they do manage to come stumble across this, like my heartfelt gratitude. So they do, because what they jumped on a 12-hour flight immediately after playing a high level game themselves. Like, so yeah, they came out, watched the All-Ireland final together, got the kids some top class training, got the adults some top class training, you know, developing that sporting side of it. And also giving the kids the chance to be kids. So simple things like, you know, there's a shop across the road from the place we're staying. So they could go across the road if they wanted to, not have to worry. In case, you know, because the police siren didn't mean that all was a raid. The trip, most of the kids had never been outside Ramallah in their lives. And the trip from a man from the border to a man was about an hour. That's the longest they ever would have been over the checkpoint. So stuff like this, you know, and like they were so excited by these simple things. I say they could just enjoy being together and messing. And I say they're bound to be lads, like they can have to all kind of mischief, but not bad mischief, like, you know. So being with their friends, and these be things that I remember made massive memories for me as a kid. Stuff like this, and I took them different parts of Oman, showed them different things and whatever else, and spent a couple of days in Aqaba. Aqaba's on the Red Sea, because some of the things the kids were so mental to do was to swim. So the first day, first they got there on a Friday and then Saturday. They all came down to the lobby in the morning after breakfast. All their swimming shorts because they were demanded to go swimming. Someone took them to the pool. They're all jumping and running and loving life. And you know, trying to get them to leave was nearly impossible. Like, you had to wait till they were starving. But yeah, and took them to the Dead Sea again, where they could swim and stuff like this. And for me, even for myself, quite maybe quite selfishly, it was really heartbreaking because he's looking out at Palestine, and you're like, that's so close. Why can't I go? Or like putting up an Instagram story and the location saying Al Quds, 30 kilometers. But anyway, to tie it all back to Aqaba, Aqaba is like a seaside resort. It's right on the border of Palestine, Umm Al Rashish. There's a port there that's been emptied due to Yemeni actions. So there is, which was interesting to see. But yeah, so the kids got to go to the sea for the first time, and to be with there and to experience that moment was something else. I can't put words into it, and see the joy in them, you know, and like in and out, and they kind of go in, like they go in like no, not in and out. They go in and they came and come out to like sit on the edge, and then go back in again. They wouldn't leave, stuff like this. And I remember one day we were there and they all start shouting. They're like, oh, you know, like really excited. And myself and Claire kind of looking around, we're like, what's going on here? What's going on? There was a wee wave. It was a really calm sea. It was a wee inlet. So it was a really tiny, maybe like not even a foot. And they're all going mental this because the first time they'd seen a wave. And as I say, like, this isn't a pity thing. This isn't, you know, like, oh, look at them. No, this is like, just, it really impacts you. This simple things that they're denied purely because of who they are, you know. And Palestinian beaches are some of the most gorgeous beaches in the world. The Mediterranean Sea is unbelievable. All this, and again, just, you know, for the moment until liberation comes, they can't.
Yeah, no, that's utterly touching, mate. And I guess it kind of puts, you know, like you're saying, folk kind of like us in the developed world and all that, with, you know, the sea means nothing. Most folk have kind of been there in some regard, whether it's here in Britain, or going abroad someplace to do it. And you've got people in passing have spent their whole life landlocked, essentially, in refugee camps in that as well. And aye, it's heartbreaking to see or to know that the brutality and the inhumanity of the Israeli project extends so deep. And like you said, it's twofold. It's nice to see, you know, kids be finding that joy in that, because for a youth that's every single day doesn't know whether a British sponsored bomb is going to drop on top of them, to be able to have those moments they'll remember for the rest of their lives, is it's a true mark of, you know, the work that you've done and all that. And I think there's many folk in the movement who'd, you know, praise you for that,
Oh,
and
look,
being the
I can't
opportunity to
accept any praise,
be there.
because the way I see it is, how lucky am I? This is my role. You know, how lucky am I that my house isn't getting demolished? How lucky am I that I don't have to pick up the rifle? You know, look, you can always think you can do more, and you always should struggle, strive to do more. Like, but yeah, the praise is for those who resist every day in whatever form that takes.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I hope as a reward for that as well, one day we might be able to get them back and actually go to Ireland as well.
Whatever about going to Ireland, I want to be all of them in their home villages in the Free Palestine.
Even better.
They deserve the world, but
Better.
they'll settle for freedom.
But no, cheers for that, mate. And I guess the kind of final point to kind of cover, we've talked about the kind of GAA games taking it to Palestine and whatnot. But in terms of the general solidarity with Palestine, it's been a massive resurgence following Israel's genocide and its barbarity. It's been really brought to the centre over the past, you know, year and a bit, and the different avenues that have emerged and the different solidarity groups that have re-emerged, or some that have, recently been established, have, been making a real massive impact into, how people perceive Israel. It's not just some kind of like wee quirky conflict happening in the Middle East. It's a real kind of plague to, the rest of the world as well. Like we kind of touched on there, the billions that our own government spends propping it up and everything else in between. But we've talked as well in the shared history and the solidarity even years ago and just before the 80s, essentially, between Ireland and Palestine, Lebanon, and other places like that. But in terms of the marches that we're seeing out in the streets today, more and more people joining and taking part in the BDS, just like they did years ago against South Africa, and all these other things in between. From the words of yourself, someone who's been there and seen it, how can you characterize and really define the importance of that international solidarity and the what it actually does for the Palestinian people who are oppressed every single day of their life?
I can't stress enough the importance of international solidarity in every single facet. From my own experiences, the really simple, like the simple, like frankly, kind of like surprising things of like 45-year-old guys in Palestine who were kneecapper, stuff like this, like those things of being visible and being standing up and accounted for and marching or whatever you're doing or wearing your keffiyeh or the really simple things, they matter, so they do. But obviously these symbolic things and these pressurizing things and some that I didn't really think about too much until very recently was the fact that the Palestinian narrative, the narrative of freedom, has completely overtaken the Zionist narrative in Europe now among the masses, and that's no small feat. So ensuring that, because a lot, as we've touched on before, there's a lot of money going into overturning that. There's a lot of money being spent then also on materially arming the Zionist regime. Like we speak to the UK, but it's a $2 billion deal with Elbit Systems, while our health system falls apart, while roads, homelessness, any myriad of issues. So yeah, that's kind of about keeping the narrative strong and on track. That's one thing, but the other thing then is that material, affecting that materially. And how do you affect that materially? It is those three simple words: boycott, divest, sanction. And the way to do this is being organized, because that is our strength as a class, or what can also be our weakness. As we act together, there's an awful lot we can do. We saw South Africa, but if we act up by ourselves, you're fighting an uphill battle. So there's some great initiatives around Scotland, the Apartheid Free Zones campaign in Edinburgh, Aberdeen, Glasgow, similar, smaller, more community focused ones. Look about it, get involved. There's a place for everyone and everyone's skills in this movement. And as I say, even if you feel you have nothing to offer, which I doubt for most people, you all have shoe leather. There's always something you can be at. And like the thing is, whatever this quick phase ends now, there's going to be another phase. So there is, not quick phase, acute phase, I should say. I say quick phase because you see a quick genocide in Gaza and a slow genocide in the West Bank. But yeah, whenever this acute phase ends, there will be a next step. We need to be ready for that next step and to support it. And the Palestinian people are moving for freedom. So yeah, it's a simple thing. Get organized, agitate for it, educate yourself, educate those around you, have those difficult conversations. And yeah, never stop speaking about Palestine and never stop working for freedom, whether it's for your class or for whether it's for a nation.
Oh, bang on, mate. The only other thing I think I would add into that would be taking the fight with unions as well. Yourself
Yeah.
know, by their own definitions, socially progressive as well. So we have to take it in that we're unions. For my sins in a past life, I've been reincarnated as a member of the GMB. If you're in that union, then you support Palestine, the struggle with it as well. The likes of Unite and our Prospect Union, where these unions represent workers within the arms industry or the defence sector. And the unions have fallen very, 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 very short on supporting their own members and taking action at these workplaces to stop component parts and other pieces of technology from reaching Israel that are being field tested on Palestinians as well for the all for the sake of selling it forward in the future, if that means a wider NATO conflict further east in Russia and Ukraine. It's being tested in the Palestinians just now, so we need to get the topic of Palestine and our unions and our workplaces, and it's a damning indictment of the unions that there's workers in these sectors who don't feel that they can go to the unions with their concerns in terms of the total immorality of the genocide and how their workplace the business they work for supports it, and they have to go elsewhere to other Palestinian groups to express themselves and whatnot. So it's utterly shocking for the leaders in these unions who dismiss these concerns, or activists who are doing the groundwork within the unions to move away from prioritizing imperialism. They're labeling Palestinian activists and peace activists as bad actors. So if you ever need an example of if what you're doing is right, just look to see if somebody in the union leadership is saying you're a bad egg for standing for Palestine. That'll let you know exactly how in the right you are for standing up for the people. So I just want to thank you again, comrade, for coming in the show to talk about it. And I guess just to round up from yourself, just to see if you've got any kind of final talking points or whereabouts we can find you on social media, etc.
In terms of social media, my best recommendation would be to follow the National for the SPSC or for the PSS in England. Follow your local branch, see what's going on, get involved if you're not already. Again, as you mentioned, the trade unions, there's usually trade unions for Palestine, different places in your locality. Get involved in that, and as always, follow the CPB and YCL everywhere you can. Always on the right side of history, and I'm proud to be a member, and it's led me to do what I can for the subject.
No, perfect comment. And again, thanks so much for coming on. I can't wait to get this episode out.
Okay, gourmet the bag.
Thanks again, comrades, for tuning in to another episode of Spectre. As always, be sure to leave us a like and review on whatever platform you're tuning in on. And of course, share us with your friends, comrades, co-workers, and anyone else in between. It's vital that we stand tall for Palestine and her people. Whether that's in our local Palestinian support groups or in our unions fighting for real change. Kahal Ghaleen's story is just one of many. There's been countless activists who've went over to Palestine to see firsthand the brutality of Israel and its apartheid regime. Many such people have also gave their lives as martyrs for Palestine and its people. But we all must do whatever we can to support them. Life for the Palestinian people under Israeli occupation is a dark and miserable cloud that hangs over them every single day. But there's moments when there's massive inspiration that strengthens the resolve and will to fight. There's moments where the light shines through and resistance grows. Whether that light is the image of a burning Israeli tank amongst the rubble or a schlitter blasting its way into the net from a hurdle. So let's continue the fight for Palestine here in our own home. Let's continue to fight until the last rebel. Because if there's one thing we know for certain, is that from the river into the sea, Palestine will be free.
أنا دمي فلسطيني 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 أنا دمي فلسطيني فلسطيني.